This week on Law & Disorder, we'll examine the U.S. government torture memos made public by the Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union lawsuit. We'll talk with Bill Goodman, an attorney with Goodman & Moore, representing New York City protesters who were detained at the RNC in horrible conditions. Randy Credico, director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice, will explain some recent minor concessions New York State recently made to the harsh Rockefeller drug laws. Attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard with the Partnership for Civil Justice will give us a sense of what type of military presence to expect at the January 20th presidential inauguration and will update you on the Bush administration's efforts to stifle protest at the inauguration. All that and more coming up on today's program. Stay tuned. Welcome to Law & Disorder. I'm Dahlia Hashad, Arab Muslim South Asian advocate with the ACLU.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author. The great civil liberties attorney, Bill Kunstler, saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, especially now since 9/11. And at a certain point, it'll be irreversible.
Here on Law & Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. We'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We will be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We'll be lawyers you'll like. Us now in the studio is well-known comedian Randy Credico, also the director of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Welcome, Randy.
Thank you.
It's been 7 years. You've been traveling up to Albany to protest the Rockefeller drug laws.
Yes, we actually started way back in May 8th, 1998, was the 25-year anniversary of the Rockefeller drug laws. We had our first vigil in front of Rockefeller Center, and we thought it was going to be a one-year battle. And here, 7 years later, hundreds of vigils, you know, in front of courthouses all over the state, Albany, hearings, Argentina, bringing the Argentine mothers up here, the Plaza de Mayo. I mean, we've done a lot of different things, and so this right now would constitute just about around 6 years.
Did we have a partial victory last week? I know the New York Times ran a front page article saying that New York State votes to reduce drug sentences.
Well, they did on the most extraordinary cases, which are the ones that we would highlight, which are the A1 cases, A1 felonies, if selling 2 ounces or possession of 4 ounces of any proscribed narcotic, heroin, cocaine, or crack. Those sentences will be reduced in the future and retroactively. But the problem is they have to go before the original sentencing judge, and it's up to the judge to decide. But it's a presumptive reduction in time.
How many years are we talking about reduction?
Well, it was 15 up to 25 to life for A1 felony. Now it's 8 to 20, a fixed time, either 8 years, 9 years, 12 years. I would suspect in Manhattan you'll get 8 years, and in Ulster County you'll get 20 years, just like, you know, the problem right now with a lot of judges give you 15 here and they give you 25 upstate. But the time you will get, and place will get like 1/6 off of good behavior. So people who have been in right now serving like 15 to life who've done 7 or 8 years could actually get out, because many judges, like in the case of a guy by the name of Miguel Arenas, who was sentenced to 15 to life, the judge wanted to give him 3, but he couldn't. So he'll get his sentence reduced, and he'll be able to go home after 10 years.
But the mandatory sentences are still intact, aren't they?
Yeah.
So
I mean,
judges don't have really any more discretion.
No, well, you know, there's still the judges can give you a minimum of 8 years. That's his discretion. It doesn't matter what your involvement in the drug crime is. If, let's say, the 5 of us were in a car and there was 4 ounces of cocaine in there, we could all be charged, even if it belonged to me, we could all be charged with possession. And it's happened before where they've gone into a home and there's 3 people in there. Everyone in that house, regardless of their connection to that bag of cocaine, all received 15 to life.
Randy, it's Michael Smith. Congratulations. I think it was a victory, a partial victory. But, you know, anytime you get one person out of their clutches, it's a victory. How many people are we talking about? How many people are in prison presently for violating these draconian laws? And how many people you think are going to get out because of the partial victory?
Well, they say 450, which is, you know, the half of 1% solution. There's actually 17,000 people in there under the Rockefeller drug laws, mostly predicate offenders, low-level nickel bag dealers. They won't have their sentences reduced. I'll give you the case of Darius King, who was sentenced to 11 to 22 years for selling, an attempted sell of a dime bag. And it was the second offense within a 10-year window with drug crime. And so he was offered 4.5 to 9. He wouldn't take it. The judge said, told you to take that, and gave him 11 to 22. His mother's 77. Mm. She takes care of his daughter, who's 18 and paralyzed from the neck down, while he serves 11 years in prison.
This is not a white college graduate,
No. He's actually a smart guy, but it's mostly, you know, it's 95% black and Latino and 100% poor.
And the devastation to the communities is large.
One problem is going on that I foresee helping out Republicans in this country for the next 1,000 years, and that is this drug war. People are being disenfranchised left and right all over the country. I mean, especially with the feds. I mean, what's going to happen in New York? And I hate to keep jumping all over the place here, but I have a tendency to do that. Is in New York, what's happening is that the feds are going to get involved. And if the Rockefeller laws go down anymore, the feds will get involved in a lot of these cases. They are already in Fort Greene. They just rounded up 60 people. All 60 people will lose their voting rights, even if they plea out to a couple of years or probation. And in Texas, there's been 6 of these things. They've gone from, after 2 years, they've gone from the state making these arrests to the feds making these kind of sweeps. And the threshold for guilt is much lower in the federal system.
Randy, isn't the main criteria for guilt still the amount of drugs in a person's possession?
In the Rockefeller drug laws, yes. And let me just tell you how ridiculous it is. For A1, it's selling 2 ounces, possession now 8 ounces. For an A2, it's selling over an ounce. Now, over an ounce, or possession of 4 ounces. Anything else for a sale is a B. Anything, a nickel up to an ounce, you know, you could sell 28 grams or a nickel bag. That is a B felony. And that right now is, it was 8 1/3 to 25 years, the same as rape, manslaughter, and embezzling over $1 million. That will now be a fix for the Bs in the future. You'll be given a fixed time between 1 and 9 years. If you go to the judge, the lowest is 1 to 3 now. Now it'll be just 1 up to 9, and you can get out a little bit on good behavior. But that doesn't go retroactively, though, which is the big problem.
Oh, it doesn't?
No, none of the people in there. There's a guy by the name of John Martino, a Vietnam War veteran up in Rochester in Monroe County, who was serving 15 to 30 for selling nickel bags. The guy has post-Vietnam War syndrome. He's in very bad shape. You know, he's got Agent Orange. The guy was selling nickel bags to support his habit. And, of course, he's black. Rochester, he got originally 44 to 140, and the appellate division softened it to 15 to 30, even though he's got like a terminal disease. So he won't get his time shaved at all. Not at all. So there's a lot of horror stories, and that's what puts the pressure on Albany, is as long as we can continue to showcase horror stories. Of course, the most dramatic ones are the A1 felons. There's so many of those. Now we have to locate a lot of the B felons, as in the case of John Martino and Darius King.
Is there any other advanced country on the globe that has these kinds of...
Malaysia.
Malaysia
and Thailand, you know.
Really, that's where we're competing with.
We went from having the worst drug laws in the country to having the worst drug laws in the country. So they're still bad. They're still, particularly on B felonies. I mean, it's amazing that you just, you know, a nickel bag can still get you a lot of time.
Do you expect more reforms to come soon?
You know, who knows? A lot of people think that this is the, you know, the first domino, the rest will fall. Other people think that's it. They've addressed it. And, you know, this one took, the last time they made a minor change was doubling the weights, and it was in 79. That's 25 years ago. I mean, 7 years has gone by with a lot of pressure. I mean, we're talking about you know, statewide, 87% of the public supports reform of the Rockefeller laws, and yet we only got a minor change. I really don't know. You know, you ask me today, I'd say nothing's going to happen in the future. You ask me tomorrow, I'd say, you know, just the beginning and a lot's going to happen. It is just a beginning. It just depends on how important people take this, you know, and everyone should be alarmed by it because the police have incredible power. They can still plant stuff on you. They can take away your voting rights. They can throw you in jail. I mean, any one of us here politically could have a dime bag. In the old days, you'd have to plant a body on someone like the guy out in L.A., the Black Panther, Geronimo Pratt, right?
Yeah.
Now you could just put a dime bag on someone and take them out, you know, still. I mean, I'm sure that happens. People are taken out of the community, and you know, no one gets acquitted. This is worse than like Peru. No one gets acquitted in this city or in this state. In the Bronx, you get a few acquittals, but it's just if you go to trial, you lose. You lose.
Randy Credico from the William Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. What do we do next?
We've run out of tricks. We've come up with every trick in the world on this thing, you know, from having the mothers, the Plaza de Mayo up here, the stage and phony press conferences. I mean, we've done everything we possibly can do in the spirit of Bill Kunstler, you know, who, you know, we kind of burlesque this thing in many ways. And it's really show business. And we got that from Bill. And I don't know what's next, you know, other than a revolution. No, you know, voting out Elliot Spitzer, maybe. If he gets in, he's going to be a little more enlightened than George Pataki. Mm-hmm. And a Republican Senate switching over to a Democratic Senate. This is worse than the Taiwanese Senate, you know, that it's been like Republicans for 40, 50 years up in Albany. It's like, you know, the Senate for life when they moved from China to Formosa. That's what you have in this state. You know, but it's switching a little bit. They just reduced the majority by 4 votes in the state Senate. And I think if we got rid of Joe Bruno and we got someone in like David Patterson, if you believe in Democratic politics, that would be one way that we could get a major change because Patterson is very enlightened on this issue.
Well, Randy, thanks for all the work you've done to help make this happen.
Thank you. And don't forget to come by Rocky Sullivan's Comedy Club every Tuesday night.
You're there every Tuesday.
At 8 o'clock. That's what I want to do. I want to go back to that.
I've been there, and I'll be back at Rocky Sullivan's Comedy Club Tuesdays.
The police were just being really aggressive and bringing out their orange fences and, like, fencing off random sections of streets and arresting those people. Completely arbitrary.
They did the Brave New World instead of the 1984, which worked, you know, by telling us we're going to leave 20 minutes later or 2 hours later, and we're like, we shut up.
The police were pushing us back away from the area where they were arresting the people in the die-in, pushing us about 2 blocks back with their nightsticks and in riot gear. And there was only one of them, one in a white shirt that seemed like a supervisor who was actually aggressive. He was knocking us down. He did not care that he was being filmed or photographed.
We're real pleased to have with us on Law and Disorder attorney Bill Goodman, who's a partner in the law firm of Moore and Goodman, former litigation director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. What the Republican and New York City Police Department did to us during the Republican National Convention here in New York. Bill's been litigating this, just started the lawsuit. We want to find out what's happening, what we can expect from it. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Can you tell us what's at stake here? Who are the plaintiffs? What did the cops do? What are we trying to do with this lawsuit?
The plaintiffs are a group of people who representing the class of people who were arrested. There were almost 2,000 arrests during the period of the Republican Convention, which was August 27th, essentially, through September 2nd of this year. They're suing the city of New York and a number of high-level officials within the New York Police Department, as well as Michael Bloomberg. And what they are saying is that for that period of time, in a number of ways, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, was suspended on the streets of New York. The First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, in certain respects, were suspended, and an exceptional situation where the Bill of Rights did not apply existed for people who wanted to politically protest the domestic foreign policies of this government. What's at stake, I think, are the basic democratic rights that we constantly have to fight for and I think are in grave danger and more endangered all the time.
What were some of the infractions specifically that are cited in the suit?
People were arrested primarily for disorderly conduct, which is a violation. It's not even a misdemeanor under New York law. That means obstructing traffic, failing to disperse. They were arrested for parading without a permit, which I think has some constitutional infirmities as a criminal charge. There's a violation. Some of them were arrested for misdemeanors, reckless endangerment, first, second, third degree riot, those kinds of things. What was done to the people was that they were arrested, I think. These are labels that were pinned on them. Many of these people were arrested without any probable cause that they had done such things. The people were standing on sidewalks. The hallmark, really, the one of the key pieces of evidence in this case that these arrests were suspicionless and baseless is that so many innocent bystanders were arrested. People who were picking up food takeout food. People who were going to the movies. There's a 15-year-old girl who was just going to the movies with her friends who was arrested. People were running to catch a bus. One of the plaintiffs is a vice president of a very large financial institution, a major bank in the world, who just happened to be running to catch a bus and got swept up in all of this. What the police were out to do that day was a number of things. One is the idea of preemptive arrest. Arrest anybody who was likely to be protesting and saying things that the Republicans didn't want to hear, didn't want to see on their television screens. Those people were just picked up and kept for long periods of time so that they would not be able to continue to arrest. And the other is that they were arresting protests. They were arresting locations. They weren't arresting people. If you were in the vicinity of Fulton, right around the corner here, of Fulton and Broadway, and whatever you were doing, whether you were protesting or whether you were walking your dog, that was it. And you were on ice for, you know, a day or 2 days or sometimes close to 3 days. So that's essentially what we're saying.
And what about the conditions under which people were detained and the length of detention?
Yeah, those are the other two counts in the complaint. That people were kept at a place called Pier 57. Now, this is a former bus terminal. It's a former pier on the Hudson River that goes into New York Harbor. It's owned by the Hudson River Park Trust Company and was leased under a memorandum of understanding by the trust to the New York Police Department, with the understanding this would be used as a secondary holding site. By August 30th, Connie Fishman, who I think is the president of the trust, wrote a letter to Ray Kelly, who's the New York Commissioner of Police, and said, "You've deceived us. We agreed that this would be only for secondary holding purposes, and you've used it as a primary holding facility." So the lies start there. That's a major lie that's in the middle of all of this. The place itself was totally unfit for human habitation. I seriously doubt if they had a certificate of occupancy. It was covered with chemicals, and chemicals which not only were filthy and disgusting and made life miserable for everybody who was held there, but chemicals which were dangerous, which were toxic, organic hydrocarbons, friable asbestos, you name it. The people who were there, where there was virtually no place for them to sit or lie, had to sit and lie on the floor. They were breathing in, taking in through their skin these kinds of horrible chemicals. So it was filthy. And then they were kept far longer than they ever should have been. 24 hours is the outside limit under New York law. Most of the people were held longer than 24 hours for no reason, because they couldn't get the fingerprints processed, they claim, on time. And there was no way to process fingerprints at Pier 57. You stayed at Pier 57 for 10, 12, 15, 20 hours, and then you were transferred to central booking, where maybe, if you were lucky, after another 10, 12, 15, 20 hours, you got your fingerprints processed, and then you were arraigned or released. And many of the people weren't released until a judge, literally with a threat of contempt, forced the city to release hundreds of people.
Bill, did they really have to fingerprint everybody? Is the lawyer supposed to fingerprint
everybody? They don't have to fingerprint everybody. They don't have to fingerprint people who are guilty of violations. If you're driving a car and commit a violation, let's say you don't turn on your turn signal when you turn a corner. They'll give you a ticket. They don't take you. They don't have to take your fingerprints.
So the fingerprint excuse is really flimsy.
It was absurd. It was a part of this, hyper concern about terrorism, where there was absolutely no need to be concerned about terrorism. They were concerned about terrorism with who? With people who were engaged in political protest. Those are the people who were targeted for this kind of treatment. If you were in a large crowd somewhere else, if you went to Yankee Stadium that day, they weren't fingerprinting you if you threw a bottle at somebody. It really is targeting protest, and it's an attack, an assault on the First Amendment.
Bill, you think that this was cooked up by the New York City Police Department, or do you think that they were just the front for Washington and the federal police and the FBI and the Joint Task Force and the whole construction that they've thrown up against us over the last, say, 5 years?
Well, one of the police commissioners, John Colgan, who was the person who was in charge of Pier 57, has claimed that the reason that they had to use the extra precautions they had to use was because there was federal involvement in all of this. So, right. I mean, I'm sure that the FBI and the Homeland Security and whoever else, and the Republican Party, in my opinion, had their fingers in this pie, and they were stirring it up and making life miserable for people who were saying things they didn't like. It's really the essence of anti-Americanism, in my humble opinion.
And mine, too.
The last thing I think I was read in at least my local paper, they were calling it Guantanamo on the Hudson.
Guantanamo on the Hudson, that's what my partner John Moore called
it. Not that it's so as severe, but it had some of the characteristics, which is essentially indefinite detentions without taking anybody to a court, conditions that, resemble essentially a hellhole, et cetera. I mean, I guess that's what Jonathan meant.
Right. And not only that, but I think, it's obviously a point. There's a spectrum here. If you start with Pier 57 and you end with Guantanamo, pretty soon they'll meet somewhere in the middle, and we can expect, unless we fight back and fight hard, we can expect that Americans who engage in political protest will sooner or later be subject to the same kinds of horrifying things that non-citizens are subjected to at Guantanamo.
I think that's right.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Bill Goodman from Moore & Goodman, lead attorney in the class action lawsuit.
One of the lead attorneys.
One of the lead attorneys. And one of the best attorneys you're going to find. Thanks, Bill.
He's the best, but he's only one of the leads.
More than 6,000 people have now endorsed the January 20th counter-inaugural demonstration, which will line the Bush parade route in Washington, D.C. This is a permitted demonstration. As Bush travels by limousine up Pennsylvania Avenue, he will be greeted by thousands of protesters demanding an immediate end to the criminal war in Iraq. The country and the world must see that the people of the United States are in the streets from the very first day of Bush's second term.
Mara, I know that you've been involved in at least a half a dozen cases litigating against police abuse. What has been the results so far with your negotiating with the police in D.C. On the upcoming counter-inaugural activities that we all support?
Well, as you know, I mean, there will be mass demonstrations in Washington on January 20th, 2005. There were huge demonstrations 4 years ago, on Bush's first day in office, when the parade route was completely lined with anti-Bush protesters. And the scene that people have recently seen, those who saw Fahrenheit 9/11 saw the scene. Some people saw it for the first time. And people have been organizing. The Answer Coalition called for a demonstration at the inauguration, for there to be an anti-war demonstration, no matter who was elected, this past June. So there's been mass organizing going on for months. And the permits were put in a substantial period of time ago for space along the parade route. That's the heart of where the activity takes place. That's where Bush rides in his limousine. And that's where the Bush-Cheney Presidential Inaugural Committee wants to hold its coronation event. And they don't want to see protesters marring what they think should be a very pretty day for them. The government is stonewalling. And we have met with the police. They are refusing to advise what portions of the permit request they intend to grant or deny. People have the right to assemble along Pennsylvania Avenue, but what they are indicating is that they are trying to give first preference to the private Bush-Cheney Presidential Inaugural Committee, which is, in essence, privatizing what has often been referred to as America's Main Street, which is Pennsylvania Avenue. And they are asking donors for $250,000 and sums like that to be able to be given special access, including to the inaugural parade. And we believe that the people of the United States have the right to come out, stand along that street when that limousine goes by, and make it perfectly clear what they think of Bush.
Back in 2000, didn't the inaugural committee block demonstrators' access to the parade route? Did you challenge that in court?
We did. What happened was they tried the same stonewalling tactics then, and our organization, Partnership for Civil Justice, also on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild, went into federal district court and filed emergency litigation to force the government to allow protesters along the parade route and to let them in. And on the day of the parade, at the primary checkpoint, they set up checkpoints for the first time 4 years ago, and of course that was before September 11th, the Bush-Cheney PIC, working with law enforcement in joint illegal action, actually seized control of the primary checkpoint to the permitted space for demonstrations and tried to shut it down and stop protesters from coming in.
So they're privatizing Pennsylvania Avenue, just like a couple months ago they privatized Central Park and wouldn't let us have a rally there.
That's right. It's the same type of conduct. And it's also like the RNC in the way that they tried to get protesters to agree to go anywhere but where the heart of protest was, you know, anywhere near Madison Square Garden, when they tried to relegate people to the West Side Highway. And some groups were agreeing to do that, and then people, you know, who were coming and people within the anti-Bush movement said, you know, we're not going to stand for that. And that's the same thing now. They want protesters to go anywhere but the parade route. They will be happy to give permits for parks all over the city. But if you don't get to the parade route first thing in the morning, protesters aren't there first thing in the morning. If that's not where they go, they will not be seen. That's what it was 4 years ago. You've got to get there, and you've got to be out there along the route to make your point of view known. And the government is trying to do everything they can to disrupt that at this point.
4 years ago, we saw that, from various reports, we saw that undercover police officers dressed as protesters actually tried to disrupt protesters and the protests. Do you anticipate something similar?
Well, that 4 years ago, there were two Asian provocateurs in particular who were in plain clothes, and they came into one of the primary areas for protest along the parade route, and they attacked protesters. They were hitting people and pepper spraying peaceful protesters along that route. And it's an extremely provocative action occurring minutes before the limousine was about to come by. And for a substantial period of time, the government denied that those were law enforcement agents. In our litigation, we were able to prove that the two guys who did this were on an intelligence detail from the Metropolitan Police Department and deployed specifically to that area, and that they carried this out as part of their duties as police officers. We have been litigating this issue, and of course we always hope that the police will comply with the law, but we generally have no guarantees of that.
Mara Verhaeghe-Hilliard, what is it, not legally, but politically and strategically, you think is the most effective challenge to this government repression?
I think it's mass assembly. I believe that, and I think that's why there's so many National Lawyers Guild attorneys around the country who bring these types of actions, because it's really a matter of open democracy in the streets. If people feel that there is no other way that they can communicate and get their message out and really cause massive change in society, because, you know, the people in the United States who really make the difference are the ones who are able to come out in the street in huge numbers, in huge assembly, and to change the direction of the country when they believe that they have a corrupt and illegal government, or one that is owned by corporations, and that's what we're seeing today. And when the government tries to disrupt mass assembly, either by violence, through threat of violence, through trying to restrict access to public space on the streets, that's a clear effort at repression of a progressive change. So I, you know, believe very strongly that going into the courts and fighting for that space is important, but the ultimate issue is fighting really for the right of people, and then for people to come out into the streets.
For those of you just joining us, we have with us on Law and Disorder Mara Verhaeghe-Hilliard, who runs the Partnership for Civil Justice, a public interest law firm in Washington, D.C.
Mara, what happens if this permit is denied?
Well, the way that the regulations work is permits are deemed granted unless denied. Mm. We don't believe that there is at this point in time or can be a legitimate basis for the denial. We are evaluating what steps we would take, whether or not we believe that litigation is appropriate. We expect to have further communications with the police and with law enforcement. But we know that people are going to be along that parade route, and we expect people to be along that parade route by the tens of thousands. We simply do not think, nor do we think anyone is going to accept, that the Bush-Cheney administration can privatize the parade route, can simply sell it to their highest donors, and tell the people of the United States that they can't come out and tell Bush exactly what they think of him.
Thanks very much, Mara.
Thank you so much.
In October 2003, CCR and the ACLU, with some other groups, filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Defense Department and other government agencies seeking records concerning the treatment and interrogation of detainees in U.S. custody, the deaths of detainees in U.S. custody, and the rendition of detainees to countries known to use torture. They received no information. In June of 2004, CCR and the ACLU filed a lawsuit demanding the release of this information. Government agencies are just now handing it over. These documents have become commonly known as the torture memos. Among the information revealed, FBI agents saw U.S. soldiers abusing detainees at Guantanamo as early as 2002. Visiting FBI agents saw military and civilian interrogators using, quote, highly aggressive interrogation methods that include a female soldier climbing on top of a detainee's lap, another female soldier grabbing a prisoner's genitalia and bending his thumbs back. A long-haired, long-bearded detainee was gagged with duct tape that covered much of his head and hair for refusing to stop reciting from the Quran. A prisoner was threatened with a dog and placed for 3 months in intense isolation in a cell that was constantly flooded with light. After 2 months, it was clear that the detainee was experiencing extreme psychological trauma and was talking to non-existent people, hearing voices, crouching in a corner of the cell, covered with a sheet for hours on end. One interrogator was so abusive to detainees that they often wound up, quote, curling in the fetal position on the floor, crying in pain. With us in the studio, we have Omar Jadwat, an attorney with the ACLU. Omar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Dahlia.
Omar, there were a couple of really striking things in these memos. I mean, apart from the types of abuse, but one thing you mentioned, which was that the president actually authorized a number of these tactics. And one of the documents, it's the one from May 22, 2004, that the FBI sent out when it was supposed to report on abuses shortly after Abu Ghraib, has these sentences in it that are just remarkable. We are aware that prior to a revision in policy last week, an executive order signed by President Bush authorized the following interrogation techniques, among others, sleep management, use of military working dogs, stress positions such as half squats, environmental manipulation such as the use of loud music, sensory deprivation through the use of hoods, etc. When the FBI writes about this, they are saying, we're assuming that what you want us to report is nothing like that, because that we don't consider abuse because the president authorized it,
right.
But that you want us to go beyond that. Now, what's remarkable is when this was released is it got picked up almost nowhere in terms of that issue. I'm just interested in what your thought is about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the things in all of these cases, we know there are, you know, dozens of cases of deaths, many of which we still lack the documents for. You know, to really find out what happened, you know, what kind of accountability, if any, people have been subjected to, and then to hold people accountable for not holding people accountable, you know, to the extent that people haven't been punished for what's going on and that there haven't been rules enforced about treating people humanely and in accordance with both the Constitution and international law, you know, that lies at the feet of the civilian people in charge of the Defense Department and at the feet of the highest level commanders in the armed forces.
Yeah, that's command responsibility. It's a war crime under Geneva. I mean, it's clear that the problem here is that not only are they not investigating the actual people who did a lot of the stuff, they're not going up the chain of command really at all. And, of course, you can't expect the Pentagon particularly to go up the chain of command. And Warner, who was doing the congressional investigation, I think, I don't know who's going to be the new head of the committee now, but he was told apparently that if he really dug into this thing in the Senate Armed Forces Committee, that he would not be running for re-election again if he went into it, because he had some independent thing to say about it.
Omar, what's really profoundly troubling is that everyone knows, especially the FBI, because they say they don't do it, that these interrogation techniques don't work. So what's really troubling is, why do they continue doing it? Has there been any discussion about that? Why are they out there torturing people when it is of no practical, apart from the moral question, of no practical value? Why are they doing that?
It's a very good question, and one that we ask all the time. I, at least in some of the individual soldiers' accounts, people feel like it's a way to take out the frustration of the difficulty of being. There's a really striking first-person account, a statement from a soldier who had beaten an Iraqi who was under his control, a detainee. He said, well, he wouldn't be quiet, so I just started beating on him, and I just kept beating on him. And there were people sitting around, and I just, I popped him in the face, and then I hit him again over and over and over. So the question is why? And he said, well, I think I was just pissed off that there were people around our base with guns, that we had been shelled repeatedly. I mean, and of course, the guy who he had beat on turned out to be totally unimplicated in any kind of action against U.S. troops, And I think that it's, to a certain extent, the idea that you can take out or punish people collectively, in a sense, for what other people are doing. I don't know if at some deeper level that's what's going on.
But one thing that happens, I think, in that is when you get an authorization of all kinds of techniques that are sort of off the books or that lift up or lift away the rules that normally govern interrogations or human mm-hmm. treatment, is people then feel free to go beyond that.
That's right.
And so my view is that once you start lifting that lid off, people act like they do, whether it's Americans or Germans or whatever population, they begin to act in an inhuman way.
Yeah.
So I think that's certainly, so I put the blame in both ways, one for lifting it on the upper level people as well as for, of course, not investigating and prosecuting people.
Well, the administration for some time has been saying that, for example, at Guantanamo, their purpose is rapport building, that it is important to build some kind of rapport and dependency between the detainees and their captors. What does this do to that whole theory or to this myth that they're putting out there in the American public and actually internationally,
right,
that what they're doing out there is they're creating some sort of confidence building so they can get valuable information to fight this global war on terror?
Well, it's certainly difficult to build a rapport with someone when you've shackled him to the ground and kept him naked in a freezing room for 48 hours.
I don't think it's Michael Smith. I don't think you can separate the torture, which is an order coming down from above, as we've now demonstrated. I don't think you can separate the torture of detainees from the whole conduct of the war in Iraq. I mean, they just took out a city, Fallujah, 300,000 people. What are the statistics? How many children have died over there since they raided Iraq? And I don't think you can separate that from just the general notion of Western racism against what are called third world people, going all the way back to when the Belgians decimated the Congolese people or the Americans decimated their own slaves or the Germans did it to Jews and Gypsies and others. I mean, I think that's what's so disturbing to me about this, is that it's just an aspect of this whole, degeneration of civilization, sanctioned from, as you guys have demonstrated now, sanctioned from the top on down in writing. Bill Kunstler used to say that was what was so extraordinary about Nazi Germany, was all these laws were written down. Everything that was done mm-hmm. to all these people were, judges decreed it, lawyers argued it, clerks wrote it down, people inventoried it. It was all there legally, just like, Michael Ratner walks into the studio today with this document from an FBI agent. It's all here in writing. And they go about business as usual. It's just, you grind up human beings, and it's just all out there in writing and and nothing is, no one's shocked by it.
Yeah. Was there a special attempt to put this into writing? Because it seemed that FBI agents were trying to make it clear that they were not participating in the torture. They weren't participating in the quote-unquote harsh interrogation tactics. And I wonder if that's in part a response to the fact that FBI agents went to these detention facilities and saw prisoners being tortured by military interrogators who claimed to be FBI agents falsely.
Yeah, I mean, I want to address that, but I also want to pick up on something that was said earlier. And I think that, I mean, one of the striking things to me, and one of the things that maybe doesn't come across because we tend to focus on the particular incidents where people are being, you know, hurt, is something that you were talking about, which is like this dehumanization process, right? That's really more than like inflicting pain, you know, physical pain on someone at a particular moment, that what the whole whole detention interrogation system is really about is dehumanizing people, I think both for them to break them down psychologically, and also to make it easier for interrogators and other people to treat them as badly as they do. Yeah, you know,
whether it's Muslims now, or whether it was Tutsis or whatever. It's a traditional, unfortunately, way of looking at the other and saying they're inhuman, or they don't come within our context of what human is. And it does allow that. It does allow people to say, well, plus they just label everybody as a terrorist who's down there. So you get to Guantanamo, and it's assumed they're terrorists. So once you're a terrorist there, then all the gloves are off, even though they never had a trial. And likewise in Iraq, when they picked up those 10,000 people, you know, and you get an order that says actionable intelligence, and then they think the insurgency can be cured by finding a few the guys who are the leaders, and they're going to break everybody down to find it. So I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge degree to which the FBI's concerns here are about their institution and the idea that the FBI is going to be blamed for abuses that happen. Almost as much or maybe more so than the fact that abuses are happening at all, it's the concern, as one of the emails says, that the FBI will be left holding the bag.
That's a really strong point, because I do think it's in writing for the very reasons you're indicating, that when from the memos and from other things that have come out, when the CIA decided or wanted to torture people in various facilities around the world, they didn't want to do that without legal authority. They didn't want to be left out there. And one of the reasons for all these memos and all these torture memos, you know, that come out is really to give the authority to these agencies, because they don't want to be left holding the bag, as it said that we didn't get authorization from the president or Rumsfeld, et cetera. And so it's all in writing because these young guys or these agencies, they don't want to take the risk, because they know that they could get hit by criminal prosecutions at some point in their lives, and the agency could be blamed. So I think that's right.
So they had the understanding that eventually this type of torture would come out.
I don't know that they had the understanding, but I think they had the fear. You know, I mean, I think a lot of bureaucratic practice is making sure that if things go bad, that you're not the one who's being splattered. So.
Well, there's two things. One, partly the original torture memos that came out, I think came out because of controversy within the department over the Department of Justice as well as other places. The question I have for you is, you know, here they've been sitting on these documents, and we're going to get thousands of pages more. Why aren't they fighting harder to keep us from getting them? In other words, the judge ordered them, yes, but they could have appealed. They could have done other things. Is it that there's some dispute going on within the agencies? Why are we getting documents that are really, you know, that are really killing these guys in terms of their excuses?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's interesting is the documents the FBI gave us are documents that don't make the FBI look particularly bad. And the documents that we got from the DIA
don't make them
look particularly bad either. You know, just because of the way the bureaucracy works, it's each of those agencies that's processing its own documents. So I don't know whether there's a certain degree to which people are putting their best foot forward.
Right. No, I think that's a good point.
Preemptively.
That's actually a good point. Yeah. Yeah.
For those of you just joining us on Law and Disorder, we have with us Omer Jadwat, an attorney with the ACLU, discussing the recently released torture memos. CCR filed a 170-page brief in Berlin asking the German prosecutor to investigate Rumsfeld and several other U.S. government officials regarding torture. And they have as their clients four Iraqi detainees who experienced serious torture, one of whom had his genitals injected with an unknown medical substance. Besides going to Germany, what are some of the ways that we can hold our government officials accountable here?
I think all the tools of advocacy can and should come into play here. So one of the things is just convincing people that it's a real story that people really care about, you know, and I
that's
think
a good, you know, but the question, how do you do that? I mean, you go on radio a fair amount on this. You get on in America, people, they think, well, these are terrorists. We go a little beyond the law. I mean, that's the argument you get. In Europe, it's a different understanding.
Right.
But here it really is a hostile environment. Well, we shouldn't be doing this to people in Guantanamo. And everybody says, well, look, they're beheading us over in Iraq, so right. Et cetera. How do you answer that kind of?
I don't know the answers to those questions. I think one of the things that has to happen is for that assumption to get broken down a little more, you know, and that hopefully in the course of the Guantanamo litigation that's ongoing and in the course of, I mean, the idea that torture is never justifiable, right? It doesn't matter who the person is that's being tortured. But I think the reality of the situation on the ground is so different than the average American thinks it is. Like, the idea that we're somehow surgically choosing the people who are most culpable and subjecting them, you know, these very high-value detainees or whatever, to bad practices which, you know, are somehow contained and don't spread to the general population is just so divorced from the reality of the fact that people get sold, villagers in Afghanistan got sold, you know, for, what was it, $3,000 each to forces and, you know, found themselves in Guantanamo months later. You know, I mean, I think that there needs to be, I think that part of the reality of how you start to get people to think more seriously about what's happening to these people is to realize that notion that we've kind of selected the worst of the worst or the most, you know.
The answer they give to that, I think, that is a way. But, of course, the answer is I had a debate with somebody the other day, and he gave a sort of Benthamite utilitarian thing. He said, well, look, we got 600 people in Guantanamo. Let's say only 20 of those people are terrorists. Suppose the terrorists are 10. Isn't it so we make some mistakes. So we do these torturous interrogation techniques on 400 or 500 innocent people, but we're going to save thousands and thousands of people. And that's the argument. I mean, you don't have to answer right. that because there's no sort of answer to that right. except to say, you know, you just can't. That's just ridiculous. You just can't do that. That's completely illegal.
And, it just you know, doesn't but, work. Right. It doesn't work. I mean, at Guantanamo, someone reported seeing a prisoner shackled at the hand and foot to the ground. And next to him was a pile of his own hair. He was suffering so badly that he pulled out his hair and created a huge pile of it next to him. What valuable information are we going to get out of any human being suffering so much? And assuming that anybody there has any valuable information to give at all.
And some of these documents and some others say that they're now afraid of releasing people because what we've done is taken a lot of people who had nothing to do with terrorism or anything and made enemies out of them in terms of the United States.
And you have to wonder, you know, to what extent. I think one of the very striking things to me has been that they've abused people so badly at Guantanamo. And, I mean, what were they thinking, that these people would never get out? I mean, is that what they were thinking, which is why they felt like that they could go ahead and, you know, no one would ever learn the truth about what had happened to them? I mean, it's just – it's a real puzzle to me.
The fact that I think there's – such widespread abuse that interrogators feel so free to do things like sticking a lit cigarette in a detainee's ear or smacking them around at will indicates to me that they believed that they were protected from any kind of retribution, that their actions were sanctioned and even encouraged within the system and that nothing would ever come of it.
Of course, I mean, the irony is it's to the extent that anyone is going to be held – has been held accountable for anything that happened, it's the guy who actually puts the cigarette in the air. And, you know, and so they were kind of doing what seemed like it was accepted, legal, whatever, approved. But they're the ones ultimately, you know, who have been left holding the bag to the extent that anyone has.
This is Michael Smith. I've got a question for both Omar and Michael. These torture techniques didn't come out of the air. I'm reminded of what the British did to the Irish prisoners, or what the Israelis do to the Palestinians. Is there any connection between those that you know of?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think that there's kind of a – these techniques do come up over and over in all these different contexts, you know, and I'm sure people get together to share their trade craft.
I do know that with regard to – not necessarily the techniques, but certainly with regard to the assassinations and targeted assassinations, that when the U.S. started contemplating that, a team from Israel came over, a legal team, to provide the legal justification for that. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if a whole set of these techniques are being shared, and I think particularly in these detention facilities around the world that are really secret, the underground ones, and those where there's cooperation among a lot of the intelligence agencies around the world, that these guys are doing a lot together in those. But
yeah, I worked as a human rights lawyer in the occupied territories, and I think there's a strong connection between the types of abuse that you do see. And there is a deliberate attempt not only to subdue people, which is not defensible, but to humiliate them. There is no purpose to wrapping an Arab prisoner in an Israeli flag, as the U.S. military has been doing, other than to humiliate.
Yeah, no, that was an amazing thing to me. Some of the early days, someone told me at Guantanamo, when you did your Muslim prayers, what they did is they had American flags on all four walls so that whichever direction you turned, you were essentially kneeling to the American flag. One thing which, when we started, you had mentioned, which I think was really striking to me about these documents, was that when I interviewed three of my clients, the Tipton Three, in England in March of 2004, this year, they had talked to me a lot about everything from the dogs to being chained to the floor, but they particularly mentioned women, and they used the word prostitutes, and I actually tended not to believe them. I thought this is, you know, maybe it's because of some sensibility they have around women, because they're Muslim men or something like that. And then when these FBI documents come out, and the actual real use of women against men in particular, but Muslim men with special sensibilities. And during Ramadan, I think, in the case of the woman who sat in the guy's lap and grabbed his genitals, that you began to realize, I mean, just to what extent they're actually exploiting religion and the religion of the people in a way, as well as what you said, how it really confirms the stories that have come out altogether.
It's dogs are frightening to any prisoner, but the thought, at least among the people who design these policies, is that particularly scary for Muslim prisoners, you know. Similarly, you know, public nakedness is humiliating to any prisoner, but more so to Muslim prisoners. And so, yeah, there's a very clear and, you know, almost
sadistic
and enthusiastic
against a religion. You know, and the problem is it plays into all that stuff coming out of people like Boykin in the state, in the Department of Defense, you know, and using, and, you know, our God versus their God and the whole anti-Muslim thing. And it really plays in a terrible way. And so far, I think no one has actually done that analysis in a thorough way of how these interrogation techniques are not – they're traditional, yes, but they're also ones that are particularly meant to exploit Muslim people and religion. It's pretty shocking stuff. One other question that I think Dahya asked is what you could do, and I do want to mention that there's a number of things going on. I mean, people are trying to get congressional hearings. They're bringing various lawsuits. The center has a bunch of lawsuits against private interrogators, against damages for Guantanamo. But one thing that's come up, which is going to happen January 5th or 6th, is the hearing on Alberto Gonzalez. And as I think the listeners know, he's one of the key architects of the memo that said Geneva shouldn't apply and interrogation techniques of Geneva permitted were obsolete. And that we should therefore ignore Geneva. And I look at that as one of the base memos here. And one of the issues, of course, has been that people are not opposing him, particularly the Democrats, as strongly as I would like by any means. I don't even know what position Senator Schumer is taking here. But one thing people can do is do their best to get a hold of their senators and the people on the Judiciary Committee and oppose them. And one way to do that, the center actually has a website at ccr-ny.org where you can send a letter to either your congressman or a member of the Judiciary Committee to oppose Gonzalez. It's crucial. I mean, everybody thinks he's just going to pass through, and he may, but it's really, it's elevating a guy who was one of the architects of the torture stuff. And it's like when they pinned the Freedom Medal on George Tenet recently, which was another disgusting, one of the more disgusting pictures I've ever seen, actually. Because this is a guy who, when we talk about torture, that's where it's really going on heavy within the CIA. So people should really just go to the CCR website.
What's that website again?
What is it, Mike?
Get a pencil and get it out.
CCR-NY.org. And there's two things people ought to do. They ought to send a letter about Gonzalez immediately and do it before the 5th or 6th. And the second thing, there's also a letter you can send to the German prosecutor. We've gotten about 10,000 letters already in German and English. There's a button you can just press on the website, and the letter will go off to the German prosecutor. Both are absolutely crucial. And really, when we always ask ourselves, what did we do while we knew this was going on? We all have to do something. And while this isn't the end-all and the be-all, it's something that everybody should do.
www.ccr-ny.org. Thanks, Omar Jadwat, for joining us here at Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
To update the Lynn Stewart trial, last week the government summed up against her, and right now, as we're broadcasting, her attorney, Michael Tiger, is summing up for Lynn Stewart. His summation will be both on January 3rd today and tomorrow. And the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee invites all the listening audience to come down to the courthouse at 40 Center Street and show some support. That's the Lynn Stewart Defense, 40 Center Street, right now and tomorrow. Come on down.
That's it for this week's Law and Disorder. Thanks to our guests, Omar Jadwat, Bill Goodman, Randy Credico, and Mara Verheiden-Hilliard. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. We'll see you next time on the 24th of January at 10 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Che volevi vederti divisa, hai più spazio attorno di quando eri al mondo, ma qui più che il mondo stai comodamente, ma la terra donata non si guardi in bocca, ma la terra donata non si guardi in bocca.